patient, not an inspiration for progress, as is often argued. When I refer to a high standard of living, I am including the ability to engage in society without exclusion or alienation, have all basic material needs met, and have access to high-order luxuries that can only be determined by the culture itself. What one culture sees as a need, another may see as a luxury or want. This relativity proves the arbitrary nature of material excess, showing that such luxuries are social tools sought for social purposes. As such, it is time the drive for material excess be seen for what it is, a sociologically driven mental illness. At the same time, our misconception of scarcity and sense of lack is so deeply ingrained that the mere suggestion that modern means and available resources can currently elevate the whole of humanity to a relatively high standard of living is quickly dismissed as utopian. This reaction is natural. We've been brainwashed with the exact opposite message across all mainstream economic and political discourse. For example, for centuries now, talk of the Earth's carrying capacity has been in the background of global affairs. Simplistically, we assume the rate of resource consumption that supports a given number of people will always be the same. If the human population doubles, the resources required to support them doubles too, as a one-to-one correlation. However, this isn't accurate. While the rapid rise of global population over the past two centuries is attributed to increased productive means, extracting and processing more and more resources, there has also been a parallel rise in efficiency of use. This means our increased scientific understandings have reduced the amount of resources needed over time to satisfy the needs of the same proportionate number of people. In other words, we have learned to do more with less. The Malthusian trap ended with what has been termed the Great Divergence around the Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century. The Great Divergence started an exponential advance in productive capacity and efficiency. Ephemeralization, a term coined by R. Buckminster Fuller, embraces this more-with-less phenomenon, while other theorists, such as Jeremy Rifkin, refer to it as approaching zero marginal cost. Approaching zero marginal cost means that once systems are set up to produce goods, each consecutive good gets cheaper and cheaper, approaching zero cost or zero value in terms of production. For example, imagine a good-producing machine that costs $1,000 to build. The very first good that machine outputs effectively costs $1,000, if we leave aside any additional resources required. The second good produced would then cost $500 to create, since the output value of the machine is now divided into two goods. Now, imagine that machine has produced 100,000 goods, with no costly need to service the machine. The value of that last good produced is now 1 cent. This is the nature of approaching zero marginal cost. Digital media is the best example of this, for music, film, and other forms can be reproduced and distributed at virtually no cost across the internet, nearly an infinite number of times. R. Buckminster Fuller's assessment of ephemeralization was more general in that the whole of economic production could be viewed as a move toward ever-increasing efficiency based upon advancement in design. An example is the first computer. The ENIAC computer of the 1940s contained 17,468 vacuum tubes, along with 70,000 resistors, 10,000 capacitors, 1,500 relays, 6,000 manual switches, and 5 million soldered joints. It covered 1,800 square feet of floor space, weighed 30 tons, and consumed 160 kilowatts of electric power. It also cost about $6 million in modern value. Today, a nearly zero-cost, cheap, pocket-sized cell phone chip computes substantially faster than ENIAC and uses vastly less resources and energy. This is the most important economic development of human civilization. It debunks the long-standing mantra that there simply isn't enough to go around, and in doing so, it discredits the core rationale of market competition, scarcity. As will be discussed, there is plenty to go around if certain economic adjustments are made, and if we reverse the market-spawned value system disorder that increasingly perverts modern culture. The only ostensibly real reason that exists today for poverty and inequity is the idea that not everyone can have a 50-room mansion or a private jet. It is this infinite wants view of reality that supports the market's arbitrary emphasis on scarcity, through which we justify starving almost a billion people so 0.01% of the population can rationalize neurotic material excess. It is not enough to imagine a world that has streamlined its economic system to maximize the reduction of scarcity and the reduction of socioeconomic inequality. We must also imagine a state of social maturity that recognizes the true natural limits to human existence. This maturity includes understanding the immutable need to coexist with our habitat, along with realizing the socially destabilizing public health problems that ultimately arise due to the practice of economic competition, exploitation, and resulting inequality. While values against these practices and outcomes can be realized on a personal level, with a heartfelt interest to see change, real sociological transformation will not occur until the most dominant influence on our social psychology, our economic mode, is replaced. If what it is replaced by favors behavior that condones sustainable, collaborative, and socially just outcomes, then a cultural shift is possible. Otherwise, it is all talk. Until the social system is designed to support these new humane values and practices, there is no chance of any serious human rights expansion in the future. This is not to say that educational activism isn't critically important, as that is the path to influencing and inspiring this revolution. However, we cannot be naive enough to think the problem exists in the moral aptitude of individuals when, as described in Chapter 2, there is really no such thing as an individual expressing free will without inhibitions. Likewise, since our social nature often distorts our perception as we tend to conform to normative society, thereby preventing painful social exclusion or feelings of inferiority, we gravitate toward the irrational. Material inequality, for example, creates a psychological perception of scarcity that can be almost as real and stressful as absolute scarcity, even though the goods in question are not core to survival. In the words of anthropologist Mary Douglas, a person wants goods for fulfilling personal commitments. Commodities do not satisfy desire. They are only tools or instruments for satisfying it. Restricting consumption of goods restricts participation in the extended social conversation for which they are used. This again explains why in some societies what are deemed basic needs are often luxuries elsewhere, revealing the arbitrary nature of socially contrived needs. So, scarcity is just as much of a physical problem as it is a spiritual one. I use the term spiritual in its most technical sense, being of relating to. Spirituality, despite the endless poetic rhetoric associated with it, relates to feelings of connection with something outside the self. This can be our connection to one another, to the planet, to the universe, or to anything and everything. From our narrow individualistic perspectives, locked into localized perceptions, we limit our sense of connection at our peril, that is, peril to ourselves as individuals, to our greater society, and to the planet as a whole. A systems-based worldview raises the question of who and what we are and how we fit. Truly embracing this understanding, accepting its limitations and new possibilities, may be the very realization that has confounded our deepest sense of identity and purpose as a species. It is my personal view that our spiritual fulfillment rests in coming to terms with organizational and behavioral approaches that establish a truly sustainable and socially just society. At the core of this quest is an understanding of what scarcity truly means and how to overcome it on all relevant levels, ending socioeconomic inequality. From the structuralist perspective, this poverty of the spirit can only be resolved by building a new social precondition that fosters proper awareness, respect, and responsibility. Negative trends. Now, before such a proposal is made, we must explore the severity of our current situation. Figure 5b is a conceptual chart showing 7 negative trends that, assuming a business-as-usual scenario, suggest a perfect storm of social destabilization by around 2050. Each of these issues will be discussed in order from top to bottom. However, I would like to point out that there has been no shortage of doomsayers in modern history predicting vast crises due to human incompetence. Over time, dire predictions seem to fade, making everyone wonder what happened. It isn't that most in the scientific community who have warned of such trends have been delusional. It is that our technical ingenuity continues to surpass expectations. For example, for many decades we've been warned of peak oil, a theory predicting the irreversible decline of Earth's oil reserves. Proponents of this theory simply analyzed the known state of reserves at the time, noting negative supply trends. With growing global energy demand, it's easy to understand the concern. Yet, the focus was on the nature of extraction at the time, something we can call conventional extraction or production. Conventional oil extraction is drawing raw crude from large reservoirs under the Earth's surface. In this context, the peak oil proponents were correct. The U.S. peaked in the 1970s as far as conventional extraction goes, with an additional 37 countries deemed past their peak today. What no one expected was the technology-enabled rise of non-conventional extraction, including shale, tar sands, and hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, referring mostly to natural gas. These practices are now driving down hydrocarbon prices, making the peak oil debate mostly moot. This pattern is an aspect of ephemeralization or increased efficiency. Unfortunately, the application of technology is just as important as its power, for the alleviation of hydrocarbon pressures has only stifled what is a deeply needed shift to renewable energy sources. The rapid rise of pollution-induced climate change, along with other related environmental issues, has made this innovation in non-conventional extraction a terrible advent in the long run. While people sigh in relief at the lower cost of gas, the long-term ecological damage will no doubt harm the generations ahead. The Center for Biological Diversity put it clearly in 2013. The development of oil shale and tar sands has been shown to be environmentally destructive and water and energy intensive. Extracting oil from U.S. public lands through oil shale or tar sands would deal a disastrous blow to any hope of reducing atmospheric CO2 levels to below 350 parts per million, the level we need to reach soon to stabilize Earth's climate. Besides helping push us toward global warming catastrophe, oil shale and tar sands development destroys species habitat, wastes enormous volumes of water, pollutes air and water, and degrades and defiles vast swaths of land. Today, we have passed 400 parts per million in climbing, with ever-increasing biodiversity loss. Regarding Figure 5b, we begin with biodiversity loss and resource overshoot. At the cost of $24 million, a 4-year study sponsored by the United Nations, utilizing more than 1,300 scientists from 95 countries, found that 60% of the world's forests, grasslands, farmlands, rivers, lakes, and other known ecosystem attributes are being depleted and disturbed in an unsustainable manner. In the words of Jonathan Lash of the World Resources Institute, this report is essentially an audit of nature's economy, and the audit shows we've driven most of the accounts into the red. Corroboration of these conclusions is extensive, showing things getting worse as time goes on. Today, species are now going extinct 1,000 times faster than the rate recorded during the previous 65 million years. The sixth great extinction is upon us. There have been 5 large extinction events in the past. from the Ordovician-Silurian some 400 million years ago, to the Cretaceous-Paleogene some 60 million years ago. However, unlike prior events, it appears this one is entirely man-made. A 2011 study found that though we've put millions of square kilometers of land and ocean under legal protection, it has done little to slow the trends of ecological decline. The same study also analyzes resource overshoot in tandem with biodiversity loss, stating, "The excess use of the Earth's resources or overshoot is possible because resources can be harvested faster than they can be replaced. The cumulative overshoot from the mid-1980s to 2002 resulted in an ecological debt that would require 2.5 planet Earths to pay. In a business-as-usual scenario, our demands on planet Earth could mount to the productivity of 27 planets by 2050. In effect, all life support systems are in decline, with nothing currently sustainable about major industrial practices. As the population inches towards 9 to 10 billion by 2050, any positive outlook on future ecological integrity is arguably delusional." In the words of Professor Sir John Lawton, former chief executive of the UK's Natural Environment Research Council, "there will undoubtedly be gainsayers, as there are with the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but I put them in the same box as the flat earthers and the people who believe smoking doesn't cause cancer. Given that the entire foundation of human civilization depends on biodiversity, including the regenerative resources needed for day-to-day survival, the general political silence on the issue is quite unsettling. From fish and marine species halved in numbers since the 1970s, to 6 million hectares of primary forest lost or damaged each year since 1990, there are no positive trends occurring on the whole. Only in a world based upon capital accumulation and environmental exploitation could the denial seen today become so opaque. As for climate change, the cognitive dissonance is also profound. Even though the overwhelming majority of scientists agree on its effects and man-made sources, and even though the research goes back many decades now, conservative political and economic forces continue to pretend it is unimportant or a mere fantasy. In a 2015 work titled Climate Change, Capitalism and Corporations, authors Wright and Nyberg explore the powerful corporate resistance to any meaningful adjustment to market economics, exposing the myth of green capitalism. They report that profit-seeking businesses simply work around policy shifts designed to help the environment, while spending a great deal of money on lobbying and counter-activist influence to ensure the security of their bottom line. They write, "Our economies are now reliant upon ever more ingenious ways of exploiting the Earth's fossil fuel reserves and consuming the very life support systems we rely on for our survival. This is evident in the rush by some of the world's largest companies to embrace deep water and Arctic oil drilling, tar sands processing, new mega coal mines, and the fracking of shale and coal seam gas. These examples highlight both the inventive genius of corporate capitalism and the blindness of industry and government to the ecological catastrophe they are fashioning." The authors make a clear case that the current capitalist orientation will only drive humanity into an ever-deepening hole, despite the green rhetoric and impressive, high-profile international meetings. No significant change is happening in real terms, because the social psychology generated by the market, the root orientation of the system that guides narrow, self-interested behavior, is larger than personal discipline. Consequently, predictions forecasting the state of affairs by 2050 are bleak, with a 2013 paper in Nature projecting a complete climate transformation for the worst. This transformation will affect the low-income tropics first, destabilizing core ecosystems. A 20-year study by Yale sociologist Justin Farrell found that corporations have used their wealth to amplify contrary views of climate change, and create an impression of greater scientific uncertainty than actually exists. The contrarian efforts have been so effective for the fact that they have made it difficult for ordinary Americans to even know who to trust. A leaked draft report from the United Nations, published by the New York Times, stated that governments of the world were still spending far more money to subsidize fossil fuels than to accelerate the shift to cleaner energy, thus encouraging continued investment in projects like coal-burning power plants that pose a long-term climate risk. The report also warned that if the 500 parts per million threshold of CO2 is passed, as is predicted if trends stay the same, future generations will need to find ways to suck greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and store them underground to preserve the livability of the planet. The Times also published that it was the opinion of the report that while emissions appear to have fallen in recent years in some of the wealthiest countries, that is somewhat of an illusion. The growth of international trade means many of the goods consumed in wealthy countries are now made abroad, and that those countries have, in effect, outsourced their greenhouse gas emissions to countries like China. Since the start of industrial society, there has been a 40% increase in greenhouse gases, reaching levels higher than anything recorded in the past 800,000 years. The effects on the cryosphere, the frozen water part of our planet, have provided empirical evidence of the damage. As the ocean warms and ice formations shrink, sea levels rise in synergy, with many other factors that set the stage for a litany of negative future effects. Moving on to general pollution, trend C in Figure 5b, we see that in concert with greenhouse gas emissions, air, land, and water integrity are all experiencing negative trends. A 2016 study linked household and outdoor air pollution to an astounding 5.5 million premature deaths each year, based upon 2013 data. Half of those deaths are occurring in China and India, two countries that are employing the mid to late 20th century Euro-American model of economic expansion through dirty industrialization means. A 2015 study tracking current trends concluded, model projections based on a business-as-usual emissions scenario indicate that the contribution of outdoor air pollution to premature mortality could double by 2050. Land degradation is equally dire. According to the World Wildlife Organization, half of the topsoil on Earth has been lost in the last 150 years. Topsoil is the uppermost layer of soil that possesses the greatest concentration of organic matter and microorganisms, where plants obtain the majority of their nutrients and thrive. Today, it is disappearing at an alarming rate, primarily due to conventional agricultural practices such as monoculture. According to the National Academy of Sciences, topsoil is being eroded 10 times faster than it can be replaced. This erosion often sends toxic farm chemicals and pollutants into streams and sensitive water supplies, hurting ecology and potable reservoirs. Some have considered soil destruction as rivaling global warming as an environmental threat, with 1% lost every year. Given that it takes about 1,000 years to generate 3 centimeters, a bit over an inch, of topsoil, it has been predicted that by 2050, only 25% of the productivity experienced in the 1960s will be possible, posing extreme challenges for a population 2 times larger. As expressed by trend E, unless topsoil destruction is rapidly stopped, or there is a mass incorporation of different agricultural methods, such as soilless agriculture, serious food scarcity problems are on the horizon. A 2013 study published in the journal PLOS ONE found that even with current yields, ignoring looming problems, a near doubling of global crop production is going to be needed to meet demand by 2050. This problem will be compounded by water pollution and increased freshwater scarcity. Water pollution from farming and industrial activity has been extensive, as evidenced by dead zones in lakes, excess nitrates in water tables, and growing mercury pollution in the ocean and fish stock sourced to coal plants. While the rise of the now multi-billion-dollar bottled water industry has been good for GDP, the environmental destruction underlying it is devastating, expressing yet another example of the distorted incentives of the market structure. According to the United Nations, about 1.8 billion people will live in areas plagued by water scarcity by 2025, with two-thirds of the world's population living in water-stressed regions. The OECD Environmental Outlook to 2050 reported that freshwater demand will rise by 55% by 2050, corroborating the UN water stress statistic. Using the OECD demand estimate of 55%, we can expect that 3.9 billion people will be living in water-stressed regions by 2050. Professor Yanos Bogardi of the Global Water System Project, GWSP, has stated that severe water shortages will affect more than half the world's future population by 2050, sparking mass migrations of people, likely followed by destabilizing political tensions. A 2013 GWSP study concluded that in the short span of one or two generations, the majority of the 9 billion people on Earth will be living under the handicap of severe pressure on fresh water, an absolutely essential natural resource for which there is no substitute. This handicap will be self-inflicted and is, we believe, entirely avoidable. Mismanagement, overuse, and climate change pose long-term threats to human well-being, and evaluating and responding to those threats constitutes a major challenge to water researchers and managers alike. Overall, from a broad environmental perspective, as warned by a 2016 study by the UN Environment Program, UNEP, involving 1,200 scientists, hundreds of scientific institutions, and 160 governments, radical and rapid change is needed to stop the looming global catastrophe. Beyond these environmental concerns, the final two issues, technological unemployment and government debt, trends F and G in Figure 5b, if left unaddressed, will further increase social stress. With 47% of jobs at high risk of being taken by computers within the next two decades, and all the financial incentives to do so by business, there is no stopping this trend without major policy adjustments. This trend also shows an exacerbation of inequality as the fruits of automated productivity continue to go into the pockets of the upper class, as will be explored in more detail in this chapter. As physicist Stephen Hawking stated in 2015, if machines produce everything we need, the outcome will depend on how things are distributed. Everyone can enjoy a life of luxurious leisure if the machine-produced wealth is shared. Or most people can end up miserably poor if the machine owners successfully lobby against wealth redistribution. So far, the trend seems to be toward the second option, with technology driving ever-increasing inequality. As for government debt, it has been estimated that by 2060, 60% of all the countries in the world will be bankrupt, while the U.S. alone will have a debt of 415% of GDP by 2050. On a certain level, debt is a customary fiction and can be erased by the flick of a pen. Yet the very integrity of the capitalist system is based on the idea that the math of financial interaction, hence competitive self-regulation, will work out in the end. That is the facade that must be upheld, while behind the scenes, large powers never play by the rules. The truth is, dominant nations can extend their debts to near infinity, moving goalposts as they go along. The U.S. having a federal debt of $19 trillion, or $190 trillion, is actually only as relevant as its position in the global power hierarchy. The U.S. will never default as long as it remains a global empire, and all major nations buying U.S. bonds know this deep down. The U.S. can just make it up by way of its central bank, the Federal Reserve, which extends to a financial system with great global power, also ensuring the power of the U.S. dollar. If debts are in dollars, the U.S. simply makes more. Although people often argue that the U.S. is in debt to a private banking cartel, its central bank, and that is a problem in itself, it is really irrelevant to the broad view. The whole thing is mostly a sleight-of-hand arrangement that lets the U.S. government borrow endlessly while the banking system gets special political treatment. No one in the U.S. government and its central bank cartel really cares about U.S. government debt because money is made out of thin air. They only care about public regulation and public perception, not government spending or government debt. In the words of former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, the United States can pay any debt it has because we can always print money to do that. So there is zero probability of default. However, that is not the case with smaller nations, which are highly susceptible to international debts. Small nations face serious repercussions imposed by way of sanctions, structural adjustments, and austerity if they cannot meet debt requirements. These repercussions reduce the welfare of their citizens, decreasing standards of living and increasing the probability of destabilization. They are forms of oppression, in truth, punishment for simply being poor. Again, it is market discipline for the poor and socialist protections for the rich. The true free market is really the freedom of those with the most money and hence control. So, in the midst of all this, with mass global bankruptcy pending for most nations and a general pressure to reduce spending, the odds of seeing the kind of economic reforms required to stop the vast environmental crises looming are very low. The pressure is also against any large-scale social welfare compensation for the population to ease economic stress, along with any hope to finance the mass shifts needed to revise the global energy infrastructure. In short, we are entering into a situation that, if we are to respect capitalism's financial dynamics, will require enormous amounts of money to make the sustainable changes required. With a world in debt to itself at many times its GDP, it is very hard to feel optimistic about such changes actually occurring. Capitalism and markets simply cannot be respected if we expect to move forward with integrity. As a final note on Figure 5B, which targets 2050 as a perfect storm of negative trends, the wiggly line is the hopeful wild card. It is termed the counteracting efficiency trend, suggesting a possible tapering off of these trends to a limited degree as unexpected forms of ingenuity prevail. In the same spirit of the decline of peak oil, the figure expresses hope that these negative trends will slow so as to allow more time for large order change. Ephemeralization, which is really the only positive economic feature of modern times, guides this trend. This wiggly line is labeled counteracting efficiency, that is, inherent, to point out that some alleviation of negative trends will likely be natural to a business-as-usual scenario. Be that as it may, unless a deliberate and highly specific effort to counter these negative trends occurs, far beyond this inherent counteracting efficiency, the social destabilization on the horizon is going to be spectacular. Reconstruction. In stark contrast to the aforementioned trends, the possibility of returning to ecological balance is still very much within our reach. While a point of no return is certainly possible, if we remove the business-as-usual scenario from the equation and take a fresh look at our potentials from the ground up, the light at the end of the tunnel is profoundly bright. So bright, in fact, that we are not only able to end socioeconomic inequality and dramatically increase public health and social justice, but we can also move society toward a truly sustainable abundance. When I say abundance, I am not referring to some infinite amount of everything. I am referring to a society focused on maximizing its efficiency to reduce scarcity and economic inequality as much as technically possible, while ensuring homeostasis with the planet. This goal may sound utopian, but it is entirely practical and simple in conception. As noted throughout this book, scarcity has been ingrained in our social system and harnessed as a political tool. Humanity's sense of possibility has been severely limited in consequence, and we have unfortunately cultivated a highly competitive, dehumanized, and warlike culture as a result. In this section, attributes of an idealized economic model will be inferred to describe a system focused on maximizing technical efficiency to circumvent any pressures of resource scarcity and lack of sustainability. While what will be discussed is indeed literal in principle and general application, I encourage the reader to view this as a thought exercise in order to try and avoid subjective bias. This thought exercise is simply about reasoning what an ideal economic system would be if logically constructed from the ground up, based upon modern understandings. The goal is maximum efficiency to meet all human needs in a sustainable way. This basic reasoning, as implied throughout this book, regards structurally linking public health to social organization. It is a scientific fact that if I do not consume water, I will eventually die as a result. By extension, the means by which water is accessed, utilized, and preserved for future use becomes just as much of a technical, non-subjective issue of organization as the need to drink it. This is how, from a structuralist view, we can argue that those dying from dehydration, water-transmitted disease, and starvation in the world perish not due to the actual lack of food or water, but to societal inefficiencies that allow or create such deprivation. The mechanics that enable these inefficiencies exist in the territory of the objective, not the subjective, since we can quantify the cause and effect relationships that link food or water scarcity to broader influences and eventually larger order system dynamics. Suddenly, we see that the nearly 1 billion people on Earth who lack safe drinking water are in that condition because of the structural nature of the global economy, not due to some natural, immutable imposition of our habitat. So, this exercise, or train of thought, is about constructing an economic system technically and objectively, in the same way one builds an airplane to fly. The only decision to be made is that of purpose. An airplane is built with the purpose of safely and efficiently moving cargo from one location to another. This new economic model is built with the purpose of providing for all the people in the world in the most efficient and sustainable way possible. What has been argued in this text is that either this new approach is adopted or humanity is on a fast track to increased destabilization. In other words, as odd as this may sound, it is less about the moral issue of what is right or wrong in terms of social fairness, and more about what works and what doesn't. If the goal is ongoing human survival as a species, with the least amount of violence, premature mortality, habitat destruction, and other ultimately public health issues, what we have now is simply unworkable. Five attributes that form the foundation of this new economic model are conceptualized in Figure 5C. They include A, automation, B, access, C, open source, D, localization, and E, networked digital feedback, also generally referred to in popular literature as the Internet of Things, or IoT. Each of these represents a more efficient mechanism to achieve higher productivity and the least amount of waste and environmental impact feasible. The logic is no different in principle from the practical decision to reject using a manual screwdriver in favor of an electric one, increasing productive efficiency. Yet, they contradict the structural logic of the market system as they are based upon technical efficiency, not market efficiency. Two very different approaches to economic behavior, once again. Interestingly enough, these five ideas are actually not obscure, randomly idealized, or pulled out of thin air. People who pay attention to current social and technological trends are aware of them, yet have not thought about their broader implications. Signposts pointing us in new directions surround us, in fact, and the following thought exercise will extend their implications showing how they complement one another in optimizing economic efficiency. In effect, what underscores these new attributes is a dramatic change of our current root socioeconomic orientation. Unlike with the market, which is structurally based on scarcity, trade, competition, and exploitation, this new model focuses on strategic and sustainable abundance, collaboration, and balance. In a single word, it is about design. I wish to express that I am not using these terms poetically. I am not gesturing, saying, hey, let's all just collaborate, be sustainable, and seek abundance. Wishful thinking has proven to be of little help without a structural foundation to support goals, which is why all the poems, stories, and songs about peace, love, and human solidarity have remained an idealistic backdrop in the midst of constant human conflict, deprivation, and abuse. Also, the degree to which any or all of these changes are made is proportional to the benefits achieved. In other words, even if only partial transitions were made toward the ideal goals expressed, it would still improve things. However, the more one examines the implications of these changes, the more it will become clear how they work against the current economic system's incentives and structure. This means the ideal of a step-by-step transition and improvement is improbable. Rather, it will likely take large and dramatic leaps to move from one state to another, revealing the need for serious activism to get things done. The first attribute in Figure 5C is the deliberate application of labor automation. This means the conscious reduction of human labor for income roles, replacing jobs by machine automation wherever possible. As radical as this may seem to some, it is common sense given current trends. I will note three. First, in contradiction to the market's framework, human employment is now inverse to productivity in the sectors where automation has been applied. This means human labor is becoming obsolete, and human employment is actually economically inefficient when the automation option is available. It doesn't make sense in the same way that farming a field with 18th century equipment is inappropriate today. Second, machine automation has greatly helped facilitate the vast increase in productive efficiency and resulting standard of living increases experienced by much of the globe. As such, it becomes a matter of social responsibility and prudence to maximize this potential. Rather than enduring the relatively slow process of cost efficiency-induced automation, where companies automate only when it is cheaper than human labor, the intent should be full automation overall, favoring technological unemployment. This is contrary to the market system, which structurally disfavors automation in the interest of preserving human jobs. Structural adjustments would need to be made to incentivize automation liberally, not fight it. This approach makes obsolete the overall labor for income framework. The effect would be a rapid increase in production efficiency through the zero marginal cost phenomenon, furthering the creation of a good surplus. Third, even with the non-deliberate rise of technological unemployment due to the pursuit of cost efficiency alone, the socially destabilizing effects emerging must be countered. At the time of writing, pressure is being put on the industrialized labor force as technological unemployment inches ahead. The growth of information technology, applied robotics, and artificial intelligence are projected to move faster than society is able to create new jobs to replace the ones being automated. Because the costs to produce these machines are increasingly inverse to their productivity, they will also continue to become cheaper than human labor in most sectors over time. Statisticians tracking this rapid rise find no reason to assume any sector will be off limits from automation in the future. Economist John Maynard Keynes, writing in 1931, is perhaps the most famous for foreshadowing the issue, stating, "We are being afflicted with a new disease of which some readers may not yet have heard the name, but of which they will hear a great deal in the years to come, namely, technological unemployment. This means unemployment due to our discovery of means of economizing the use of labor, outrunning the pace at which we can find new uses for labor. But this is only a temporary phase of maladjustment. Classical economist David Ricardo, writing before Keynes in 1821, also recognized the pattern and, like Keynes, wrongly dismissed the issue as a mere temporary phase of maladjustment, not a true system contradiction. Ricardo stated, "I have been of the opinion that an application of machinery to any branch of production, as should have the effect of saving labor, was a general good, but that the substitution of machinery for human labor is often very injurious to the interests of the class of laborer. I have been supposing that improved machinery is suddenly discovered and extensively used, but the truth is that these discoveries are gradual and rather operate in determining the employment of the capital which is saved and accumulated than in diverting capital from its actual employment." Naturally, machine automation of the 19th century would appear limited in effect, functioning more as a means of complementing human labor than replacing it. It wasn't sophisticated, and it developed very slowly. Today, this is no longer the case. Professor of Computer Science Moshe Vardy, speaking at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, said, "We are approaching a time when machines will be able to outperform humans at almost any task." Using the United States as a basis, a 2013 analysis released by the Oxford Martin Program on the Impacts of Future Technology found that 47% of jobs will be susceptible to computerization in a few decades. This speculation is far from unfounded. In May 2016, the Adidas company announced it was moving much of its shoe production to Germany. However, rather than bringing new jobs to the region, as would commonly be assumed, the company described its new speed factory process that will rely on near full robotic automation. More revealing, in 2016, U.S. minimum wage protests successfully forced a move to raise the hourly rate in some states. This was considered a victory for the working class. In response, the Wendy's Fast Food Restaurant Corporation announced it was going to simply counter the move by deliberately moving to automation, reducing the workforce to avoid paying the wage increase. This pattern of bypassing increased lower-class wages and labor union demands through automation is just starting and will only increase as the primary market logic to reduce costs will naturally force increased unemployment as technology becomes cheaper. Aside from the need to adjust the economic system to allow for this new productive reality, compensating the loss of jobs, this trend also poses unique existential challenges. The idea of a paid occupation has become so ingrained in our social identity and sense of purpose that loss of opportunity can cause emotional harm, such as with the correlation between suicide and employment noted earlier. At the same time, a limited view of human nature bleakly asks, what would people do if they had no coerced labor role? This is like asking a curious child what will consume his time if it is not imposed upon. A future not based upon labor for income shouldn't be confused with a future of no creativity, progress, or incentive. While a pattern of laziness exists, often derisively associated with the working class, this can be linked to job dissatisfaction and a loss of purpose, not a blanket lack of interest in exerting any effort. As put by psychologist Barry Schwartz, "We want work that is challenging and engaging, that enables us to exercise some discretion and control over what we do, and that provides us opportunities to learn and grow. We want to work with colleagues we respect and with supervisors who respect us. Most of all, we want work that is meaningful, that makes a difference to other people, and thus ennobles us in at least some small way." There is also an age-old notion that people should only get what they work for. We all understand the ethic of work as a virtue, and also the necessity for property as a means to protect one's work. However, we forget that work is part of a social process, and that process provides countless things to us that are achieved without our need to assist in development. While a person may need to work a job to get money to purchase a computer, the value of that computer does not truly represent the countless years of scientific advancement and the countless minds it took to manifest it. In other words, for the "you get what you work for" ethic to be real, each human would need to reject the social reality and evolution of eco-scientific development and, upon birth, begin to create the entire world's industrial network from scratch. This is a ridiculous proposal, of course. But just as scarcity is viewed with no nuance through the eyes of market economics, so too is the idea of work as the only justifiable means to earn the right to life. As philosophers have argued, work, in its truest state, is the creative act of inquiry, invention, and development. The drive to solve problems is inherent to us. Our minds are simply wired that way. People have no problem working hard on what they enjoy. Unfortunately, the exploitative drudgery of our historical existence, coupled with an economic system that requires work for income, has distorted this inherent drive through arduous and monotonous labor. Jobs are not vocations. Jobs are structural prerequisites for survival in an economic system based upon labor for income. At the same time, some, rightly, see the earn-a-living reality as a mechanism of social control. London School of Economics anthropologist David Graeber, in his amusing essay On the Phenomenon of Bullshit Jobs, says, "It's as if someone were out there making up pointless jobs just for the sake of keeping us all working. The ruling class has figured out that a happy and productive population with free time on their hands is a mortal danger." The science of human motivation has found that while drudgery is burdensome, creative tasks, a sense of inclusion, and feelings of contribution are stimulating and sought after. Adam Smith was famous for cynically stating, "It is the interest of every man to live as much at his ease as he can. It is certainly his interest, at least as interest is vulgarly understood, either to neglect work altogether or to perform it in a careless and slovenly a manner as possible." This view may have held at the time Smith wrote, as noted at the end of the Malthusian trap. But today our understanding is different. Once monotonous drudgery is removed and independent, meaningful work is instilled, the floodgates of creativity, enthusiasm, and productivity open. In the words of Stanford University professor of psychology, Carol S. Dweck, "Effort is one of those things that gives meaning to life. Effort means you care about something, that something is important to you, and you are willing to work for it. It would be an impoverished existence if you were not willing to value things and commit yourself to working toward them." This helps explain the exceptional amount of work people do for no monetary reward in the world, simply seeking purpose and meaning. For instance, a 1992 Gallup poll found that more than 50% of American adults volunteered time for social causes at an average of 4.2 hours a week, for a total of 20.5 billion hours a year. This was calculated to equate to about $176 billion in value. Even in times of recession, average people continue to give and help at high rates. Aside from how this structural shift to labor automation will dramatically help create a more equitable standard of living for all, due to increased efficiency, it will free humanity from dictatorial, dehumanizing, monotonous labor roles. This freedom opens the door to a new world of incentive. Shifting motivation into creative, collaborative, and exploratory fields. As a natural course, the first areas that automation becomes applicable in are generally the most monotonous, since they are the easiest to mechanize. This means the path of adjusting society to an automated economy first removes the type of work people do not wish to do, refocusing on areas with greater fulfillment. Furthermore, highly specific to the theme of this book, this adjustment has many implications for improving interpersonal affairs and the alleviation of social dominance. For thousands of years, labor has been the main focus of human exploitation and abuse. The rise of automation breaks the need for human commodification and dehumanization, assuming we adjust accordingly to remove labor for income as a universal economic requirement. In the words of Jeremy Rifkin, "A half century from now, our grandchildren are likely to look back at the area of mass employment in the market with the same sense of utter disbelief as we look upon slavery and serfdom in former times. The very idea that a human being's worth was measured almost exclusively by his or her productive output of goods and services and material wealth will seem primitive, even barbaric, and be regarded as a terrible loss of human value to our progeny living in a highly automated world." How the system adapts to such a shift is a complex discussion, but many theorists today have returned to the idea of Martin Luther King's universal guaranteed minimum income, or universal basic income. The idea is to simply compensate for unemployment and poverty with money given directly by the state to the public. This is a logical step, along with the parallel idea of shortening the workday, as has already been experimented with in some Nordic countries. The second attribute noted in Figure 5C is access over property, by which I mean tilting the balance toward access and away from ownership. Ownership and property are foundational to the market economy. This idea goes back to the philosophical work of John Locke. However, things have changed since the time of Locke, and our high-technology society is now being hindered by the tradition of ownership, proving it wasteful and impractical. From the standpoint of technical efficiency, the general idea of everyone owning one of everything is irrational for a species sharing a finite planet. The fact is, very few goods are constantly utilized over time, with some goods, such as cars, dormant the majority of the time. This ethic of individual ownership has also been a large contributor to resource overshoot, environmental destruction, pollution, and waste. It promulgates a materialist conception of reality that further fuels detrimental cyclical consumption. Sharing and the communal commons have also existed to a fair degree, from libraries to rental systems to public transit. Interestingly, due to pressures of eco-concern and an increased democratization of commerce, we have seen a mild increase in more advanced sharing systems, from street bike depots in cities to car-sharing networks to home sharing. While the term sharing is actually not entirely accurate, since it is really consumer-driven renting overall, the phenomenon has still been dubbed the rise of the sharing economy, or collaborative consumption. The term access will be used here, as the root of the trend is about people gravitating away from ownership, relying on access to sharing networks as needed. Yet, like the rise of automation, entry into this territory has been slow and tenuous. That is because the core of the market system fights it. Access, instead of ownership, interferes with cyclical consumption and growth. Generally, there is no economic benefit in a market economy when fewer goods are produced to meet the demands of more people. Today, the sharing economy isn't really an access economy, but a fad based around consumer recycling of current ownership. A true access-based approach to distribution means good use is spread across the population, just as 1,000 people over a generation may check out a single book from a library. Let's consider the example of automobile transport. If 50 people need to drive a car, the market benefits from all 50 of them each buying a car. However, if 50 people were to share 10 cars, the economy would suffer a theoretical contraction of 80%. It has been reported that the average American only uses his or her car about 5% of the time. In 2015, there were 257.9 million consumer vehicles in the United States. Abstractly, given the 5% use time, only 13.8 million cars would be needed to meet demand if they were shared and not owned. The real number would be much higher given the logistics of such a sharing arrangement, but it certainly wouldn't come close to 257.9 million. This would mean a deep reduction of traffic and parking congestion, since the vast majority of cars wouldn't be needed. Likewise, the pollution reduction would also be substantial, especially given that hydrocarbon power is unfortunately still the norm. As with automation, driverless car technology has advanced markedly in the past few years as well. It has been estimated that this development, in combination with collaborative consumption car networks, is on pace, conservatively, to eliminate 10 million jobs. If this approach were to be combined with a more deliberate access focus, magnified to incentivize the removal of private, single-use car ownership whenever possible, the access abundance and positive ecological effects would be staggering by comparison to today. This is just one example, as the idea of incentivizing access over property can be applied to a wide range of goods genres, from tools to recreation equipment to apartments. Access is really at the heart of economic necessity, while ownership is a creation of the market system's need to store value and protect property from theft in a world based on the assumption of universal scarcity. Most property crime is generally driven by want and a lack of access. The creation of an access abundance, seeking to give everyone equal opportunity to use, means property crime would drop as abundance is achieved. This ideal may seem fanciful given the crude world we endure today, but it is logically sound. People do not steal things they can gain access to. This is not to argue an abstraction where property no longer exists and no material rights of any kind are enforced. The efficiency logic here is simply to shift the focus from property to access, supporting access rights more than property rights. The result would be the cultivation of a kind of shared commons that would be not only more sustainable and less wasteful, but also able to extend goods and services to those who once were not able to afford them. As a proxy for the creation of abundance, consider the car example again. In theory, with only 13.8 million cars needed, the other 262.1 million would be an abundant surplus. If you extend this reasoning to other categories of goods, suddenly our state of scarcity begins to look much different. The third attribute is the full incorporation of open source contribution, making all industrial and scientific information freely available. This could be deemed the cultivation of a collaborative commons. The market economy treats ideas as property to be owned and sold, and uses the term intellectual property, about which a host of laws exist. The market incentivizes the proprietary hoarding of information and closed internal development rather than open, collaborative development. This makes sense in such an economy as today's, since information and development lead to new products sold for profit, assisting market survival. Sharing information is rarely in the best interest of any company, as it makes it vulnerable to others using the information more strategically, possibly undercutting its market share and business success. The same goes for intellectual development of most kinds, since time is money in this world. A scientist who has spent years researching and writing a detailed book on a subject usually needs to copyright, sell, and protect that work, since he or she needs income to compensate for the time spent. It is just what the system demands. For years, this kind of competitive arrangement has been interpreted as the driver of innovation in the commercial arena. While this may be true to a certain degree, today it has become clear that technical innovation is actually occurring more quickly and efficiently through open source collaborative contribution than through proprietary closed development. While there is plenty of empirical evidence to support this truth, basic common sense also prevails. If we understand that technological progress is an inherently social process, with parties constantly building upon and improving existing ideas over time, then logic recognizes that more minds thinking about a given problem or proposal will always be better than a few, if organized properly. The development of the Linux operating system is a classic example. Started in 1991 by students as an experiment, the Global Mass Contribution Project was completed in just 3 years, with little monetary involvement. In 2000, NASA started the ClickWorkers Project that allowed online volunteers with no prerequisite knowledge to engage in visual analysis generally reserved for professional scientists or graduate students. More than 85,000 people voluntarily visited the site in 6 months and made almost 2 million entries. An analysis of the markings found that the automatically computed consensus of large numbers of click workers is virtually indistinguishable from the inputs of a geologist with years of experience in identifying Mars craters. In 2009, famous mathematician Tim Gowers decided to start the Polymath Project. This is today an ongoing, networked, collaborative project to solve complex math problems. Since inception, it has solved numerous problems through public interaction. Wikipedia, a user-driven online encyclopedia, is another example of overflowing public interest and collaborative contribution. While structurally limited in its bureaucracy and famous for its often opinionated undertone, it has still been found to have an error rate that isn't much higher than the proprietary Encyclopedia Britannica Online. The scope of open-source development in collaborative mass decision-making and contribution has been expanding rapidly since the dawn of the Internet. As Thomas Goetz reports in Wired magazine, open source has spread to other disciplines, from the hard sciences to the liberal arts. Biologists have embraced open source methods in genomics and informatics, building massive databases to genetically sequence E. coli, yeast, and other workhorses of lab research. There is open source publishing, books open to any use, modification, or redistribution, with readers' improvements considered for succeeding editions. Distributed proofreading, which deploys legions of copy editors to make sure the Gutenberg texts are correct. There are open source projects in law and religion. There's even an open source cookbook. The open source movement is a testament to the power of the group mind and the wisdom of crowds, and also shows that people feel an incentive to contribute to ideas even when no money or material reward is involved. While in its infancy, as numerous pro-open source organizations now plead with industry to open their intellectual vaults, the emerging reality is that the efficacy of proprietary development is losing steam as an optimized means of innovation. Yet, due to market pressures, there has naturally been a limited range of open source engagement overall. While we see great poetry in the spirit of open source, such as Elon Musk's famous release of his Tesla automobile patents, poetry is not enough. The power of open source ultimately depends on how effective the communicative medium being used is. In the digital, online realm, this harnessing of group analysis and creativity is becoming increasingly more effective. The ideal next stage of this trend is to apply the method to major industrial design projects. Through computer-aided design and computer-aided engineering projects linked online, it is now possible for economic creation to be engaged by anyone who has the skills and interest to contribute. There is no reason that the same structure and shared goals that created Linux cannot be applied to the creation of a smartphone, a boat, or an entire